Well, episode 300. You ready for this? You are listening to the For the Rose Tech Podcast, episode 300, the 300th golden episode.
Season 7, episode 300 of the Burlo Bros Tech Podcast. Today is June the 25th, 2017. I am Matthew Dean Furlow, and probably doing his final transformation from car to robot is my brother James Furlow.
Oh my gosh, I hope so. I heard this was the first one where they didn't break $100 million opening weekend, which I was like, wait, they've been breaking $100 million opening weekend still? Yes.
So this is, we got some stats.
We're talking about Transformers, by the way, in case you missed it.
Transformers.
Michael Bazian.
The Last Knight.
Hopefully the last version of this, and we can restart the franchise.
Or something. So it's got a 15% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is not good.
It's 50%.
15.
Oh, 1-5.
Yes.
You're kind of quiet. Sorry.
It got a 57%, though, on the... For the audience score, which is horrible. Normally, the audiences are dumb. They go easy on it. So that's real bad news. This is just as bad as they can get. Now, in all fairness, though, as far as Transformers movies go, none of them have done particularly well. The last one got 18%. The one before that got 35%. The second one got 19%. And the original Transformers only clocked in a whopping 57%. So it's not like this is not necessarily a doom for the franchise.
Predictor. Yeah.
But where the real problem comes in is that it's been estimated to make $70 million this weekend. And with a worldwide gross this weekend of $265 million, which sounds like a ton and worth the time. But the reality is that the production budget was $217 million, usually double that to get, once you talk about advertising and everything. So you're looking at a total cost of the studio somewhere in the ballpark of
$500 million.
$430 million invested in this movie, and it hasn't cleared 270. So it is less than 60% of the way to just making its money back. And that is how you kill a franchise.
I like Transformers, and I am happy this one's done.
So are you, when you say you like Transformers, did you like any of the movies in this cinematic universe, or were you or do you like the idea of Transformers in general?
Yeah, so I like the idea of Transformers in general. You and I spent many afternoons watching Transformer cartoons. Yes. We started out with the ones where they were like animals,
Beast
right?
Beast Wars! Robot
Beast Wars!
Yeah, I really like that one still.
Yeah, and then somehow they end up going back to the planet, and then they become cars again.
Yeah, Beast Machines. That was that series.
Beast Machines. Okay, I'm glad you've got all these names down. So I guess technically I never saw the original Transformers, I guess, because we were just a little late to the show. But I like the concept, and I like the storytelling and the sides versus sides. And it always kind of had a soap opera-y feel to it, where it was like, wait, are you good? Are you bad? Are we partnering? Like, are we overcoming this crisis together? It was a classic TV show in that regard. And I thought it was good. And I felt like the first movie... I know a lot of people don't like
Shia LaBeouf.
Thank you. Yeah. You could tell I was like, oh great, I'm going to butcher his name. I like the first one. I mean, I thought there was parts of it where like, man, this is kind of campy, kind of lame. I've really felt like they then amped up the the potty humor in subsequent movies. And it was just kind of like, now you're losing me. And I was definitely like, I think by the third one, was that his final one? That one was super frustrating for me because they set it up for him to be going through a new hero cycle. This idea of like, he just wasn't happy with where he was in life. He had done all these amazing things and it didn't seem to count. And he had all these struggles. And I think I've ranted about this before, but, and the movie was set up for, it was a story about him and Transformers were going to happen and, you know, whatever, the world gets blown up. And he never closed that loop. And I was just, from a storytelling perspective, they drew me in and then left me disappointed. It was all a bunch of guns and blowing up again. I was like, why? Like, come on. And then they just totally switched characters and I felt like there was no storyline. And the fourth one with the guy who's now kind of their franchise guy.
Mark Wahlberg.
I didn't feel like there was a storyline to that. Like, okay, he's got a rift with his daughter because she's dating a dude. Okay, big deal. Like, he's a mechanic, whatever. Like, why do I care? And they never drew me in. So this one, I'm like, I have zero interest in seeing it. They somehow made me not care about the Transformers and their plight. But yet, it almost feels like, wait, what side is Optimus Prime on? It's kind of got that soap opera-y feel to it, kind of. But I'm like, I don't care anymore.
Yeah.
Plus, I feel like I could predict what's going to happen, too, which is the other frustrating part.
Yes, you can predict what's going to happen.
Maybe I'm not their target market.
It's funny,
But who is, right? It's not for little kids, not with all that violence.
Yeah, well, so this is the thing. Their target audience is to sell toys, I think. I don't know.
Who's?
To sell toys. I don't know. I'm weird. I come back and forth. Like I set my expectations way too super high for this movie originally. For the first movie, I've only seen the first two. I haven't seen three or four, which I've proclaimed that means that I've broken the spell. I have now seen fewer than 50% of the movies, so I don't even need to be tempted to see another one because I'm like.
Yeah, you're not a fan. You're officially not a fan,
exactly,
at this point.
And I say that as a Transformers fan. I like these movies. I don't even want to. It doesn't ruin Transformers for me. It's just I have no interest in it because it's one of the things that I come back to is that like, and like I said, maybe I'm setting my expectations too high. But I like it when there is just a touch of something more to what they're doing from a literary perspective.
More than meets the eye.
It's exactly.
I appreciated those puns, by the way, the first time. Like, that's funny. I get it. That's there for me. Dude, I'm with you. Like, more transforming, more like,
well,
do more strategic stuff and then have skirmishes.
Well, and one of the
don't just like spend half the movie blowing up an entire city.
Exactly. One of the
save that for the fifth movie, maybe. Okay, fine. Build to it.
Exactly. Have it be smaller.
Take a note from Marvel.
One of the things that drives me crazy is the fact that the robots are different sizes when they train. Like the volume of the robot can't fit into the volume of the car. Like I just sit there and I'm like that. I don't know. That just cheapens it for me. Like that whole thing, and there are movies that I think have done a very good job of things that they could learn from, like Pacific Rim. Just there's a lot of problems with that movie, but from the massiveness of the robots, like just that there's this inertia in their digital artistry that just doesn't exist in the
what
robots.
Was like I think it was
feels,
I appreciate that about Star Trek,
right?
Where they were like, we built models of each of these ships. Like real, they're like they said they were digital, but maybe not. They might have been physical too. But they were like we built these things, so we had all the details, so we had the scale, so that when we were making our shots, we got it right every time.
And the thing is I feel like these movies, like I even criticize the action because I'm like I feel like the action feels kind of light and impossible, and it just. Like from the very beginning, and then on top of it, you kind of like ignore any of the literary symbolism of having these like demigods come to Earth and have to hide amongst us. Like there's such a rich tapestry of literature that you can pull on. You don't have to pull very deep. Just give me hints of it and give me something to sink my teeth into. Just a little bit. And an example of that to me, where that's well done, would be the new. They're not Luke Cage. That's a completely different thing. John Wick movies. The new John Wick movies, there's just this small hint of like, okay, these different like crime lords represent the Greek gods. And so whenever things become just completely unbelievable and unrealistic, you're like, yeah, but it's kind of like an allegory anyway, so it doesn't actually have to make like perfect sense. And those are things that have nothing to do with what Michael Bay does.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest disappointment here is that they were finally going to have other directors start making, like, start taking over movies.
Really?
As they expanded it, yeah, and this is the one that's not going to make enough money to justify anymore. Just going to kill the entire thing.
Well, honestly, it needs to be reset, and I think that's what's going to happen, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Of course, it'll just be like, we need more explosions than last time. We need to do this in VR. That's what we need.
Yeah.
And actually, we're going to talk about this. Oh, remember this thought, because this will come up later in the middle of the show. Yeah. I have an idea for them to make it better.
I like it. You know what, James? I think this is a perfect time then to just get on with the show this week, like every week.
Like the past 300 weeks?
300 weeks.
Well, 299 weeks.
Like the last 299 weeks, and not like the next 4 weeks, but this unique moment in time of the 300th episode.
Right here.
We will be talking about technology in the continuing corporate opera. And when we talk about the corporate opera, you might be thinking, what is that? What is that? That is the soap opera of corporations dealings back and forth. Talking about the people that are working for them, the marketing campaigns they're running, and of course the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James has got a short disclosure about his company that he wants to throw our way.
Yes, I founded and work for HPI. That's the former Hewlett-Packard company. However, I do not represent HPI or any of their opinions. I also own part of Twitter, Etsy, and Lending Club. And I'd also like to disclose that we're taking a break. So this is our 300th episode, and normally this would involve us giving away 300 values of something, but in an effort to pump up email subscribers. But we're not doing that, actually. Instead, we are taking what we think is a much-deserved break.
Sabbatical is what I've been calling it.
A sabbatical, like 3 months. There's your three, right?
That's longer than we agreed, but
did we? We're not publishing for 3 months. I think what we said was we're gonna take an entire month off of like nothing, like a true genuine break.
Oh yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah.
Here's the teaser. The format's gonna change when we come back for 301.
Yeah.
We don't know yet what that format's gonna look like, because we're actually gonna take a couple months. Do some, brainstorming, do some practice tests. Shows, that kind of tests. Thank you. Some pilots, I guess.
So for people who have been listening since day one, which I'm pretty sure is nobody,
I feel like there's at least two or three.
Okay, that's true. They're the first like 12 episodes we didn't publish until after, like, we published all 12 of them at the same time because we just kind of caught up.
That's what the experts say to do.
Exactly. But the idea is that we're probably going to do something not exactly like that, but similar to it, where, yeah, number one, we want to make this a little more bite-sized. We don't want this to be a 20-ounce steak, which I ate a 14-ounce steak at a restaurant yesterday evening.
Is that a lot of steak?
That is an enormous amount of steak.
Not a lot of calories, though, surprisingly.
I forget. Yeah, well... Yeah, but the potatoes with the wasabi oil on it was...
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, but it was... that was a piece of meat.
By the way, we're going to sidetrack this. Did you end up buying the new kitchen gadget? Are we talking about this later?
Heck yeah, man. Well, we can talk about it right now. Yeah. Your pictures have tempted me. We got one of the best deals we think we've ever found on a new Avon sous vide. We bought it through
Anova.
Oh, there we go. Thank you. Jeez.
It's an Anova sous vide. So I got one for Father's Day, and I've been using it pretty much every day. And for most of the meals, that I do something new on, I've been sending Matthew a picture. Like, dude, this is the best chicken I've ever had in my life. This steak is amazing.
I'm pretty excited.
I just bought some brats last night. Dude, that's what I'm having for lunch tomorrow. I'm so excited. I can't stand it.
I don't want to criticize you on air, but your well-done steak.
Hey, it's my wife.
You know, I hear it.
Which, interestingly, now that we've had it, which we cooked it at 145 for 3 hours, she got done and was like, you know what? We could do a little less well done. She's normally like, I want it like fully cooked, like just give me rubber. I'm like, oh, that's horrible. But now she's tried this. So she's like, we can back it off a few degrees. And then I want to try one where we do it more like 24 hours, not just three, see what happens. Mm. But oh, it's going to be good. So yeah, so you got a new kitchen gadget. That's a new hotness. Sous vide. Yeah,
actually, this week we got a barbecue and a sous vide at my place. So we're going to start. Man, we're going to be a meat factory this summer.
Dude.
I'm excited.
Figure out how to make the best burger, then tell me how to do it.
Okay.
And I'm going to try it.
See, the nice part about having the gas grill and the sous vide is you can like cook the meat and then in the sous vide throw the vegetables, because I like grilled vegetables. Get that going.
Oh, perfect.
It's like a delicious actual meal.
So you got I'm sure you got what I got, which is the Wi-Fi version.
Of course.
So it's super nice. So it works with Android or iOS. And so you sync it up to your Wi-Fi system or whatever. And so we did this once where I think we were cooking chicken for a couple hours. And I was in the middle of a meeting for HP and I had an alarm set. And it was like, set your sous vide. So I had already pre-put the stuff in the bag, put it in the water, had it on. I just opened up my app, said, start. And what it does is it starts heating up your water, and then it's like, okay, ready to go. And then it starts a timer. Well, I got done, and we went to go for a walk. So we just went for a walk, and while we were out walking, I checked my app real quick, and I was like, oh, it's going to be done in half an hour. Let's turn around and make let's make the rest of the meal. So it's super delicious, super high-tech. It's like the perfect trifecta, and it's crazy easy because you literally just take whatever your thing is and throw it into a bag with whatever else you want and submerge it, and you're good to go. It's pretty sweet. So you got that. Cool. Don't remember what we were talking about.
We're talking about
changing the format.
Yeah,
short form.
Yeah. Definitely one of the things are going to make this more bite-sized, yes. We're shortening it up a little
bit. Bite-sized, that was it.
we're hoping to make it a little more accessible so that everybody who is listening, you can start sharing it with people, and with any kind of luck, we'll grow the audience, and then we'll have
to
keep
doing
it. Yeah, that's
our hope. What we found is we got a good core of you. We appreciate you. You're awesome. Thank you for listening right now as we tell you about the future of cooking. And we have a desire to reach out to even more people, and the consistent feedback we get is it should be a little shorter.
Yeah.
So we're not doing that right now. We're probably gonna go over because it's episode 300 and we have an awesome list of articles. But in the future our goal is gonna be to keep it between, 20-30 minutes. 22 minutes is probably the target. And a TV show.
22 minutes? Is that what we agreed on? Oh, that's so short.
I know. I'm kind of like, how long have we been going right now? Dude, we're already 18.
I know.
Yes.
Saying.
Oh, it's going to be hard.
We have to actually focus.
Well, what we'll probably end up doing is like a monthly live stream when we do the recording so that you hit this along with the actual show itself, and we'll have the build-up, and we'll figure it out. This is what we're going to do. We're going to take a sabbatical to figure it out.
Exactly.
So if you have suggestions, send an email. Hit us up. You can hit me up. Here, I'm just going to do mine.
Go for it.
On Twitter, at James Furlow. Just be like, here's my idea. You can hit me up on LinkedIn, on Facebook, over email if you can figure that out, which you probably can. That's my name. And then, so follow me while you're at it.
There we go.
Figure out what I'm doing during our summer sabbatical.
If you want to talk at me, you can go at Matthew D. Furlow is my Twitter. Next to Wigan4 is my Instagram. Send me a picture of your written text. That's fine. Whatever. And if you want,
that's an option.
We probably won't be updating the show much over the next couple of months while we do this.
We won't at all.
Yes. But if you do want the backlog of everything we've talked about, you can go to furlowbros.com. It will still be there. It will still be up and running and parallaxing all over the place. And, so check it out. Go there. Or be square. Remember when they used to say that in high school? Be there or be square on the morning announcements. It's like a thing.
I don't totally, but I trust you.
All right. Yeah, I always thought it was really dumb. But it's one of those things where it's like, if you say something that I think is really dumb, it'll get stuck in my head, and I'll start saying it until, like, it's, you know, it's like YOLO. There was a point where I
remember YOLO?
There was a point where I crossed the threshold of not doing it ironically anymore. I mean, like,
really?
I was doing it long after anybody else was doing it, and I was doing it appropriately, which I think, even though I started out doing it ironically, means I'm just doing it. So
yeah, that's interesting. Yeah,
that happens to me sometimes. It's not good. But yeah, anyways, that's not what we're here to talk about, James.
No, it's not. We're going to talk about all sorts of stuff.
Cool.
But what we're going to do is we're going to start out with, I don't know if this is good or bad, Kickstarter. That's what we're going to start out
with. Kickstarter.
Kickstarter Gold, actually.
Gold is best.
Gold. I think it might be better titled as Kickstarter Recycling, but, you know, this is what they're going with. So Kickstarter's launched a new Gold program.
What does that mean?
And, yeah, great. It's what they're doing is they're creating a curated batch of projects to highlight to the community to fund. But here's the twist-a-rooney.
All right.
Is they're going back to older successful projects saying, add a little bit of a twistinator to it.
All right.
And we're going to re-kickstart it.
Hmm.
So, for example, what was one of them? There's a People's transparent speaker. And so it's going to come with a Flick remote. I don't know what that is, but I guess it didn't have one earlier. And then they also are going to sell a small transparent speaker, which apparently failed its funding round. There's some one by the 3 Doodler 3D printing pen. I know, you just are like, what? Their project is a new Star Trek theme edition.
Okay.
And new colors, too. So it's like things that have already been kickstarted. So in theory, I guess, if Pebble was still a company. I know. Jab! Oh! Just, I had to get that in. They could come back with their own, like what they did with the watches. I guess that would be considered like a Kickstarter Gold thing. We're like, we're still doing watches. They're just now the next version of awesome.
Right.
So it's kind of the idea. I get it. And so right now they're doing 65 total for through the end of July. Ooh, that's actually, they're going to do quite a bit of them. And so I think like 50 a month, my guess. And yeah, they have their handpicked, curated. I think I already said that. And they're just going with things that they know work and make them money. Insane. They're doing the Michael Bay approach, right? You know, let's do the same thing. We're going to change it up just a little bit, repackage it, and we'll make some more money. Yeah.
I don't disagree with them doing
Kickstarter Recycle.
This is where
what do they call it when it's a follow-on movie? What's that? The
sequel?
Sequel. Yeah. Kickstarter sequel.
Yeah. I mean, it totally makes sense. Like you said, I mean, it's pretty low rent, and it kind of, not low rent, but it I don't know, it's safe. It's very safe. And it also makes sense. I think there are a lot
to
of
play favorites too much.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of companies, I think that or a lot of Kickstarters get started and like, they don't actually make enough money to start a whole company right out the gate. You know, it's a proof of concept, but they still need to go and raise more money and if they're going to expand into something bigger, they still have to do more work. There's a company that I kickstarted super early on called Miscellaneous Goods Company, and they were making these really, really, really high quality, cool card deck cards. It's been interesting watching him
against humanity. Or?
No, they're just bicycle. I mean, they're 52, they're just standard cards, but they're really high quality.
Okay.
Well, and he was like an artist and like design, you know, I don't know. It's cool. It's ended up being a cool company and to follow it over the years. But he's the sort of guy where I think that is exactly the sort of project that would go good for him. He used this as like a proof of concept. Can I get people interested in my design style enough to actually kickstart a big project like this? And has taken that money and leveraged it into loans to actually build an online company. And I know that there's a lot of companies that do similar things where it's kind of like, you know, it's good to get, you use this Kickstarter as the first catch everybody's attention. And then you use further sales and you just, you know, try to snowball the thing. Well, this is Kickstarter saying, look, there are certain companies that have earned the right to be set apart as proven companies. They're not a risky bet, but yet they really will benefit from those sort of giant, benefit from the platform. So it's like, it's lower risk than a full-blown Kickstarter, a second Kickstarter, but the payoff is much higher than just trying to do it on your own. I don't know. It makes sense. Yeah. It definitely makes sense. And I can see why the backers would want, or the Kickstarters would want that sort of segregation. Hey, if I've done this, I want people to know that I'm a certified guy. And then the other nice part about that is if you're somebody getting started, you're not necessarily going to shoot for the moon. You want to get a successful Kickstarter so that you can get gold certified, get your product out the door, and then build on that. And so it gives the whole thing momentum, and it gives people a place to start. And I don't know. It makes a lot of sense to me of why the company would do that and build it towards that goal. Oh, I like it. And like gold. I'm Robert Duvain. I sell gold.
So anyways, I thought that was interesting. They're continuing to refine their model. They'll probably make some bucks off of it. And makes sense. There's a part of me that's... It probably makes a ton of sense to do it this way.
Yeah.
And it's probably a first step into something even bigger.
Probably. Speaking of sequels, SpaceX had a weekend of sequels. So first... And this is a little less exciting because they've already done it once, but they reused the second rocket. They didn't reuse a reused rocket, which is still a milestone that has to be...
Okay, so they have only used it twice, not three times.
So but they've now reused two separate rockets once. So, and landed both of them, which is a big deal. So, you know, you're having these successful repeat launches, which is one of SpaceX... You know, that is... When people think of SpaceX and how they're trying to innovate in the market, that's what they think about, is a company that can reuse rockets. They don't have to rebuild these $10 to $100 million rockets every time they're going to launch them, which dramatically reduces the price per launch. So that's the big thing. But the other thing that SpaceX has to crack in order to really make the economics work for them is the pace of launches. They need to launch really, really rapidly and be able to refurbish really, really rapidly.
Right.
So they were also pushing pushing forward on that one too. They've got some tests that they want to do later this year / early next year for their bigger rockets. And they got to get caught up on their schedule in order to do that. So this weekend they launched and landed two rockets, within 48 hours of each other. And
on the same pad?
No, I think they landed on two. They both landed in the ocean, but they have two different drone landing pads in the ocean. One on.
No, I meant like launch pads.
I don't know.
Because that'd be interesting. Like, if you get that one done, you're like, all right, let's wheel the next one on. No, there's no way. There's got to be too many checks.
Yeah. One rocket took off from California's Vanderbilt Air Force. That was one of them. Come on, article. Get it together. Just give me the information I need. I can't. I'm not going to find it. But the idea, but the big deal, or one of the big deals here, was that one of the rockets was actually going to geosync orbit, and there was actually...
Florida's Kennedy Space Center was the second
one. Gotcha. And Musk actually told them to not expect that one to land. There was a low likelihood of that one actually succeeding because they had to get a very heavy rocket deep into space and then land the booster. And he said that it did land. They did succeed. And I guess what happened was on Friday, it sent Bulgaria's first communication satellite to space and the rocket's first stage then landed on the "Of Course I Still Love You" drone ship in the Atlantic. It was the second ever successful landing of the reused rocket, but it was a little bumpy. Musk tweeted, "Rocket is extra toasty, hit the deck hard, used most all of its emergency crush core, but otherwise good." So, it literally, like, basically ran out of fuel as it was hitting the deck and hit pretty hard, I guess. But it landed, and, you know, so there, that's the important part. And importantly, they were not expecting it to actually succeed. They thought that it wasn't going to – they thought there was a high likelihood that the rocket was going to crash. So that's a huge deal when you actually land it and you didn't think you're going to be able to. Like I said, what they're actually trying to build towards in the next year is to start launching the Falcon Heavies, which our rocket is designed to get stuff, big payloads, to geosync, and get the rockets back down safely every time. So right now, the current generation of rockets, they're really pushing to the limit of what they can handle. The next generation of rockets are supposed to be able to handle this easy peasy, pumpkin breezy. So that's, you know, it's a big deal. It's good stuff. They're making progress. I like it. EM, Elon Musk, man.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah.
That's a big deal. Like, he wants to go to Mars.
I know, yeah.
I wonder, like, I know people like this. I've been with them where it's hard to describe how they think, but there are people where you're like, you lay out this plan, you know, of, hey, we want to go to, I don't know, I'm trying to make it sound less intimidating, where it's like, we want to build this presentation, you know, something like that. And you lay out, okay, we need all these slides, we need these components, and clearly this is my world. And and they're like, yeah, we'll take a week to do it. And then someone comes along and says, here's an idea, I'm just throwing it out there. Wouldn't it be awesome if we doubled the number of slides and got it all done in half a week?
Right.
And here's why this is a big deal if we can pull this off. And somehow it gets everyone in the room to go, yeah. Let's 4X the work.
Yeah, okay. That sounds good. Yeah.
Like, and he's that kind of guy. You get that sense where he's like, we're going to go to Mars. Oh, but not in 100 years. Not in 20. Yeah. You know, and you're just like, and we're going to do it using a rocket that's bigger than we've ever launched before. And you're like, yeah, we can do this. So those people are cool when you get exposed to them.
And
they always make you uncomfortable, though, because you're always like, oh, that's not what I wanted.
Well, exactly. And the worst part about guys like this is that frequently, if you prove to them that you can do what they want to have done, that only increases their imagination for what else could be done. And you're like, you are just, would you stop moving the goalposts? But that's, you know, that's the push that allows them
I'm working with a guy right now where that's exactly how he operates. Where I'm like, all right, we got this one tool. We're going to build out. It's going to be great. And he goes, what if we did three at the same time?
Yeah.
I'm like, whoa. Okay. You know, and builds the case for it, and you go, all right, I can see why it's really one really big one. You just tripled the scope of what it is that we're doing. Like, yeah, let's go to the drawing board and let's figure out how all this works together. He goes, great. While you're doing that, I'm going to get developers together and we're going to start building it. Like, what?
Yeah.
That order doesn't seem right. And then it's like, and then we meet the developer, and he's like, oh, yeah, we can build this, and it has all these components you need to build it out. And so I'm like, great, we'll start figuring out how we want this thing to look. And we get like 10% of the way there, and he goes, okay, we're going to hire a designer to start making this. I'm like, we don't even, like, this, it's not done yet. Like, there's a step, and it's like he's but he's good at, like, he's just always pushing. You know, I always feel like I've got to run just a little bit faster to keep up, because otherwise we're going to stumble and I really don't want to fall.
Right.
You know, which it can be tiring, but it's also one of those where it's like, oh, dude, we're going to, instead of launching in a year, we're going to launch in 2 months. Okay.
Right.
All right. I feel good about this. It's crazy. Interesting dude for sure. All right. Here's something I want you to look at.
Okay.
If you're listening to this podcast, go to furlabros.com/300. There's going to be a link there called AR Measure App Demo. Okay. And this is an example, but the website is madewitharkit.com. If you do, just click on the title when you get there, it'll show you all of them in place. But essentially, it's this guy, he created a Tumblr blog, honestly. and it's just, he's tracking different apps, specifically YouTube videos that people post where they're making things in AR using Apple's AR kit. Does that make sense?
Okay. Which they just released like a week or two ago.
Yeah, 100% beta, developer, whatever. But this is the future, man. I mean, like, I know we've been saying it.
Yeah.
But now there's these demos. This is the future, man.
Yeah.
Like, it's so stinking obvious. Like, just go scroll through the list, and you'll go, oh my gosh. All right, so here's the first one. This is the one that caught my attention. Saw it on Twitter this afternoon. It's a tape measure app. That's it. It's a tape measure. You literally, like, you have your video, put a tape measure somewhere, and then it creates a digital version of that tape measure. Measure whatever you want. It'll do it for you.
Yeah, I think the important part about that one that he showed that is mind-blowing is the idea that they're basically doing a calibration check where they lay out a tape measure, and then they go along with it, and it creates a digital tape measure that is counting off the same number of inches, and it's like it looks like it was within like an eighth of an inch over a 48-inch like stretch, which is pretty darn accurate. I mean, like, that's, you know,
this is super. I would use this app regularly to measure things, and it's just like, and there's things where, like, you on one of them, and it might be this one, actually has a target in the middle of the screen, so you move your screen and you, like, you maybe tap it to get started, and then you move it, and then it just tells you the distance from that original spot to it, and shows you a yellow tape measure on the screen. There's another one, if you go to the main page right under it, where it just tells you the distance. It doesn't show you the tape measure. I actually like the visual of being able to see the tape measure, and kind of like, if you move, the tape will move with you. It's just cool.
Yeah.
Like, dude, this is the future. Like, virtual tape measures. I didn't even think of that. Like, that's a thing. I remember when they first came out, iPhones. They had it set up where you could take a picture with a credit card in it, and they always went, we know the size of a credit card, and then we can get, like, they put your credit card in the picture, and then we can tell you what the relative size is to something,
right,
based on the credit card. This may work similarly, but it just seems so much better with AR.
Yeah.
I'm also like, dude, glasses are coming. This is going to be a thing. So another one that they had, super cool. It's this guy, he made a demo of, it was this mix of Doom and Space Invaders. So essentially, you're walking around with a Doom weapon from back in the day, and then there's Space Invaders throughout the office, and you just go around shooting them. Just kind of fun. You know, which you're like, yeah, games, I get it. That's
yeah, cool. But it's pretty impressive when you see it actually working.
When you see it, and you go, oh, dude, he just made this in like a week and a half. That's awesome.
Yeah.
just wait. And then it shows another one where it's just like an airplane kit thing. Now, what I thought was super crazy. Okay. This one blew my mind. This, like, it was so stinking simple and blew my mind. It's a moon landing. So what this guy has,
I just watched that one.
It's if you have the audio, it's even better, because what happens is this guy, it's in his living room. It's got the moon and it's the rover landing on it, but the audio playing is from the moon landing itself. And so you're listening to it, which you've all heard stuff like this, like, oh yeah, that's what it sounds like. And then you're watching it and you can move around and you can zoom in, zoom out, like you can walk around it and watch what it's doing. And that was where I just went, oh my, this is, which I'm sure to other AR developers are like, well, duh. But for me personally, seeing it, I suddenly went, oh, this is the future. There's oh my gosh. Like, imagine you could watch a rocket launch like this. You know, you could go the other way. There are different events in history that you could watch it. How about Transformers? Have a transformer in your living room, press a button, watch it transform in space, like what you were talking about, where it all fits. And you could maybe zoom in, zoom out, back it up, do whatever.
Or how about a recreation of, all I can think of is, oh my gosh, what is the name? Gettysburg. A recreation of Gettysburg. And we're going to start with Gettysburg on your tabletop, so you can get these like bird eye view of what's going on, all the movements. And then if you really want to get more in depth, you can grow the size of the simulation so that you're looking to your phone still, but now you can actually walk through it. And then, for the heck of it, let's say, you're in Gettysburg. Combine that with your GPS, see what happens. It's from experiencing that sort of thing, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I'm super impressed. There's another one. It's just BB-8 from Star Wars. I'm like, oh gosh, that's going to be any kind of movie like that where it's coming out. It's like, yeah, download this app, the Star Wars app, and play with BB-8 in your living room. Like, that's just part of a marketing, have fun with it type of thing.
Yeah.
Obviously, they got in the stickers.
Super easy.
Have R2-D2 in your living room with you. And again, I think, this is made for glasses in the future, where could you imagine, what if you have a virtual assistant that looks like R2-D2, follows you around, and is there to help you out and answer questions? Or C-3PO, I guess, since he'd answer questions. Like, Siri is C-3PO. That sounds horrible, but awesome. I don't know. I don't know, man. My mind was blown when I saw this. I was like, oh, this is so the future. This is so the future. VR, it is what it is. This is the future.
Yeah.
It's so cool. And it's like, it's on our doorstep.
Yeah,
I'm going to be downloading AR apps left and right.
Coming so soon. Oh, that's the Van Gogh model? Oh, geez. Yeah, so there's this dude, he's doing a tour of Van Gogh's bedroom, which is kind of a famous VR model that is used for a lot of demos and stuff built in Unity. And he's built an AR app that it places it on your countertop, and you're able to look around and zoom in and look at it closely, and it just looks so good. Oh, this is awesome. It's trucking crazy, as he said. Oh, and he's like looking at him zoom in like crazy. It's just amazing. It's so crazy what they're doing.
This is totally gonna be a D&D thing where it's tabletop gaming, right? You're going to put out nothing and you're gonna say, let's play Monopoly. Boom.
Yeah.
And y'all just start doing it, and there's it's gonna be great.
Yeah, you'll all have your own phones, but they'll all sync up
eventually, your own glasses. I cannot say that enough. That's the so obvious future. But yes, you'll have your own phones.
You want one too. You called me earlier this week, right? Because you were thinking about looking into.
Yeah, so my sunglasses broke.
Yeah.
I was meeting with somebody, and just I was taking them off my head to put them on, and they broke. I was like, lame. So I'm like, hey, here's an opportunity here to maybe upgrade. And so I called you and was like, hey, are there any smart sunglasses? Because I didn't see any super obvious ones while surfing the internet. And the answer is no. Which
I'm actually going to bring this up now, since it fits. But I wasn't going to bring this up. But Google Glass got an update this week.
What? I thought they killed that thing.
Yeah, everybody did. This has been kind of a surprise, for lack of a better word. They brought Bluetooth device support for like keyboards and mice and stuff. The project is basically dead, but if you have one, you can now update it. Nobody has any idea why.
I wonder if that's one of those weird things, like there was an update sitting out there that they never pushed, and at one point someone was like, why did we not push this out? And I'm like, I don't know, just do it.
No, I'm willing to bet that what happened was the project was killed completely, and they didn't really know what they're going to do with it, and somebody doing their 2080 project, because at Google they have the 20% of your day, and it's not actually what it is anymore, but it's similar. You're supposed to have side projects that you're working on occasionally, and I'll bet somebody has their side project was like, you know, they're doing AR stuff, and somebody said, you know, we could start using, like, we could do something with the Google Glass, but they needed that extra hardware input stuff. They needed Bluetooth for some reason. And they were just like, well, just give it. And once they did the update for whatever internal project they're working on, it just got pushed out to everybody. It was easier than doing an internal build. Makes sense. That's my guess. But I think the important part here is somebody internally at Google is still working on Google Glass. And I think that it is likely that it is an AR, VR-related project. Probably just...
mixed reality?
Yeah. Somewhere on the continuum. Along with that, and this is actually pretty neat because, you know, everybody, this is like the quintessential example of an app that everybody,
weren't you semi-working on a company or with a company that was kind of semi-doing this?
And I helped found a company that, well, it was something different. It's something that they would have used. Eventually they could have grown into it, sort of a thing.
Gotcha.
But IKEA is working directly with Apple. They want an app that allows you to place IKEA furniture into your home to see what it would look like. And then you could just directly buy it, which is awesome. Brilliant. Kind of like for IKEA, it's a really, really, really good idea. They take high resolution models, realistic models of their furniture. Since they're not animating it or anything, it's going to be really clear. And obviously with the fact that they're somehow doing tape measures accurately. Which I still don't understand. That is going to be something that people are going to tear apart and come back with. Because that is really hard to do based on... unless that's only
capable... I don't know. We just saw a bunch of apps that were doing
it. Well, this is my guess. They're doing it on the 7 Plus. My guess is that because with a depth sensing camera, that is one of the advantages of the depth sensing camera, is you have these fixed depth measurements that allow you to relatively accurate actually decompose depth information. And then on top of that, you include the AR for tracking, you now know both how big something or how far something is from you and where it is, which is really and truly all you need to know its size. So I'm guessing that those demos are using, that the really accurate ones are using the dual camera setup.
Yes,
but I might be wrong. And if I'm wrong, holy cow, it's still real. I mean, like, that's even more impressive.
Well, the other option would just be have a reference something.
Yeah, and... but that doesn't feel very Apple-y. But you're right,
I'm just saying, you could, you know, if you put a piece of paper down on the ground, you go, okay, that's an 8.5 by 11, got it. You know, you could.
Yeah, maybe. But maybe that's it. But
it's not that, you know, if you got a plus version with the dual cameras, you don't need that.
Yeah. You can drag the furniture around and get an idea of what it might look like in your home. And you can even use the app to make sure the size is accurate. The new app will be better with the help of Apple's technology and experience with AR. Pottery Barn and Lowe's are working on the same stuff. And
totally, as they should be.
Yeah. I don't know. It's one of those things where it's like, this is sort of your, this is your low-hanging fruit. This is the first generation of when apps first got released to the iPhone. There were a bunch of dumb apps. There were a couple of really useful apps. And, you know, and that's what's so exciting about this is that big companies are jumping or wading into the waters and saying, hey, let's take the low-hanging fruit where it makes sense. And then, yeah, let's build on that. And
this reminds me of, like 4K or HDR for televisions, where when that came about, all the TV manufacturers were like, oh yeah, we're doing that.
Yeah.
Whereas like with 3D, you never really got that sense. And I feel like there have been other things that they've added to phones for people like,
Yeah.
I kind of feel like the gyroscope, right?
Yeah.
It's one where you're like, it's cool.
Yeah, people didn't exactly. Like Force Touch didn't have didn't have the same sort of enthusiasm as this. You know, I think overall it's been kind of a cool inclusion. I like it, but it didn't get the same sort of reaction from developers. And I think you haven't seen people experiment with different types of use case scenarios as a result, and you haven't seen that it really hasn't evolved past, the user interface hasn't evolved past what was launched with it early on, which is peeking into menus, pulling up extra contextual stuff, using the cursor on the keyboard, you know, your basic stuff. Yeah. Whereas AR, I think this is really just the tip of the iceberg, and because companies are going to want to differentiate and say, oh, our experience is better, and Apple's just giving them all sorts of crazy powerful things to do that with. I think it's exciting. I like it, James.
I love it. I'm so pumped.
I was like 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was like ready to pull the trigger on the Zenfone AR, which is Google's they're going to be their flagship AR VR phone when it launches in a couple of months. And I was like, I was ready. I felt it. I was like, you know what? I know I'm going to have to get a new watch. I'm okay with that. I know I'm going to have to get it. I'm going to have to get Chromecasts. I'm going to have to dive into the ecosystem. Ugh. I'm going to have to switch over to be Android fanboy. But I was like, wow. I was so disappointed by Apple's debut of what they were doing in AR and VR in particular. And jeez, just at the last minute, they're coming around, saving the day. Drives me nuts. But
you like the roller coaster, be honest.
Yeah, I guess. But yeah, no, man, it's cool.
It's cool. It's cool. And I know all a bunch of Android people. We've had this for a while. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but the problem is that it's when you have huge. When you have huge fragmentation in your software package, and there are hardware requirements that aren't pushed out to every phone, then it just doesn't get the adoption that you need. And that's why Google wins these sorts of battles, is because it's going to come to every single phone, their solutions, and which is pretty dang amazing when you think about it, that they're able to do that.
We need to create a For the Rose podcast app that uses AR so people can watch us and walk around and see our screens with the article we're talking about, and then flip back and see us. And I don't know, I'm just making it up, but
I like it. I'm into it, man. Yeah.
Sounds like we can do it. We got the kit.
Yeah. Yeah. Jeez.
It's good. Let's do it.
Very good. Hey, there was actually something I was supposed to bring up while we were talking about this with the VR stuff, right? With
I was talking about the Transformer thing.
Robots in disguise.
Yeah, no. My idea was it's related to that moon landing thing where you could have a Transformer in space, watch it transform in front of you, and you could decide, okay, do I just want a 2-foot miniature, or I would like to see the full size thing?
Yeah,
in my front yard.
Yeah, which would be pretty cool.
In my driveway, which would be pretty sweet. And I imagine you throw on a set of earbuds or earphones and let the sound just kind of fill you up. which is this weird, like, it's VR, AR, right? It's a mixed reality. That's the idea.
Right.
Because, and same with, like, the rocket launching. Wouldn't that be sweet to be, like, you know, I'm maybe not standing right next to the rocket, but maybe, like, I wouldn't mind being a mile away from the rocket. Let this sucker rumble.
Yeah.
And that would be pretty sweet. Full size, you know, again, don't have to go small. But just that idea of some of those historical things that have happened. What if you were watching a NASCAR race and you got to watch a crash? And, you know, and which, I don't know, that sounds horrible, actually.
Yeah.
But,
incredible.
But again, just this idea of,
like,
or what if it's like you're watching
this is
a horse race, right? Something like that, where you can relive some of these moments, and I don't know, I'm losing it. There's a lot of, I think, educational pieces, like looking at molecules and atoms and things that you normally couldn't see, being able to actually manipulate them and move around with them,
yeah,
while learning about them. Like, there was one, it was a solar system example. Like, that's kind of cool, solar system in your living room.
There was a company that I met. They were working on building these digital, they're doing VR, but their whole idea was they were going to build these spaces where you could, like, have meetings and build stuff and do demonstrations and take notes and stuff. And the idea that they're kind of working on is sort of this modified memory palace idea. And because I don't know how familiar you are with the idea of memory palaces, but they're
not totally.
So it is it's classically a Sherlock Holmes method. He's the one who's kind of made it popular in pop culture, but it's this idea of the ability to memorize huge amounts of information, facts specifically. Because one of the things we know is that memory,
I need one of those.
Yeah. Is that memory is based on connections. That trying to memorize disconnected things is very, very difficult. Memorizing large chunks of information that's all connected, like a story, is relatively easy, which is why mnemonic devices work so well. And you should always go with, it's okay to go with nonsensical mnemonic devices. What's important is go with the first mnemonic device that you think of. Because what ends up happening is your mind is pulling the closest connections and drawing them to this one thing you're trying to memorize. And what you've done is you've made the easiest connection for your brain to remember the word and the definition, or the person and the name. So we tend to be visual spatial creatures, and so a mind palace is this idea of you want to take... You want to take that a step further. Imagine that you have a place where you're at, a palace. This palace is huge. It's got wings. It's got rooms. It's got outdoors. It's got indoors. It's got basements. It's got attics. And in each room, you can go to a room and put particular types of information, categories of information. So names and people go in one room. And actually, maybe this is easier to think about this way. You have, in this palace, you're trying to memorize all the names for somebody for a big meeting. You've got 100 people that you got to memorize their names and face to names. What you can do is you can put them in different rooms, and you sit there and you look at a picture of the person's face, you look at their name, and you say, okay, what room would this make sense going into? Okay. And you imagine yourself going to that room and putting that name and face, putting that person in that room. Then when you actually see the person's face, you can go, oh, what room are they in? Then you imagine yourself going to this imaginary room where that person is, and your chances of remembering their name skyrocket. And so,
interesting.
Yeah, it's a really weird mechanism but it's all about forcing your brain to use what it's good at to memorize things. So the reason I bring all this up is these guys are creating these virtual environments where you literally do that. Like, there are all sorts of things that you think about when you're in a meeting, when you're developing an idea, or you're learning something new that are built on contextually in the place that you are. And so they're like, throw on a VR headset, go into this fake world and customize it and configure it and move things around and put digital objects and put little reminders so that every time you go back into this room, you're flooded with memories of why you did it that way. And I talk about how my company would really be benefited from that because we have a relatively small office and our projects are always, we always do modifications. Like we have this core concept that we make slight modifications and customizations for it. And sometimes 3 years later, you have to remember why you customized something the way you did, and we just didn't take good notes of it. But if we had, if every project had its own virtual space, whether it was AR or VR, where we could go back to this unique place and where we came up with all these decisions, then all of a sudden we'd be like, you could rebuild that area instantly and go trigger all those memories of, oh yeah, I remember why we did that way. And
right. Okay. Yeah, I do that with, I mean, like, not on purpose, but like with spreadsheets, I'll go like, let me reopen this.
Exactly.
And just the act of reopening the spreadsheet, I go, oh yeah.
Right. And so this is the way that, and I think one of the cool ones to bring this all back to ARKit, like I think that little things like this are going to be huge, where these digital spaces where you can completely refresh them, reopen them up, and rethink through these ideas are going to have huge benefits to your ability to memorize things or recall things that you have memorized but you can't get to because you don't have the correct pathway to get there. This is completely...
I'm thinking, like, my number one is names.
Yeah.
Like, of course, if I just have a heads-up display, it could solve my problem. But...
I have a weird memory palace mechanism that I've discovered over the years that I have, but it's whenever I build things into stories, like why does this exist? Give me the story of it, and I can just enumerate fact after fact after fact if I know why it got there. And it's because when I was younger, obviously I was like really big into storytelling and coming up with stories, and I would memorize these huge sweeping epics.
Yeah,
novels would. Worth many characters, many different worlds, many different things. And so I developed this way of remembering all of these facts, or I could rebuild these giant stories, and unintentionally, that's how I remember stuff. Like anything I learn is put it into a story and I can rebuild it. I can rebuild the facts that I need. Which is kind of a weird idea of like, are they really facts at that point? Well, kind of. If they're necessary to get from the plot from point A to point B, then they're sort of a fact, aren't they? anyways. Yeah, I don't know. I like this stuff. I'm excited about it. I'm excited about what's coming. Probably going to get the new phone when it comes out. I'll stick with Apple.
I am. I'm on the subscription drip. So
yeah.
It's definitely happening. I'm going to get all this AR awesomeness. Oh, I'm excited.
The other,
you may or may not hear our review, depending on
what. Yeah, exactly. but yeah.
We'll definitely talk about it again.
So one of the things that I think is important here is that we are definitely, it seems as though we might be entering a golden age of VR, AR. Pretty excited about this. So I read a pretty good article on TechCrunch by John Evans this week, titled "How to Kill a Golden Age," and I think it's actually more interesting.
Is this coming back? Are we just talking about Transformers all night? Is that right? What we're doing?
Yeah, it's not unrelated in a way. Now that I think about it, I actually think this is really more interesting as a question of how to build a golden age. And thing is that he's not the one who came up with the theory of how to build a golden age. So that's not how he's just eliciting it or explaining it.
Okay.
Try to put his twist on it. So anyways, he kind of starts the idea of, he was sitting at the Theater of Salt in Florence with my friend Joe discussing golden ages, as one inevitably does in Florence, having been the birthplace of the most famous and most consequential of all golden ages, the Renaissance.
This is in Italy.
Yes.
Got it.
And I found myself speculating that Silicon Valley's own golden age is at a real risk of ending soon. I don't think anyone would dispute that the last several decades have been golden age. It goes into some examples. The show.
Come on. Mention the second one.
Like Intel or Hewlett Packard, then Apple,
yeah!
Alphabet, and Facebook. It is now
the golden age.
It's now widely taken for granted that this golden age will go on. That this ecosystem of startups and giants and startups becoming giants and giants acquiring startups has become an unstoppable flywheel.
Feels like it.
Yes. There is a history of golden ages achieving what seems like apotheosis and then just stopping. Renaissance spread like wildfire through the rest of Europe, but in Italy, the wave crested with Michelangelo, and then it broke. And then he talks about Hollywood's golden age of the 70s and their kind of movies.
We talked about this last week with the superheroes.
Exactly.
Golden age of that.
Yep. It's an era which William Goldman famously explained that nobody knows anything about box office success. And so they tried everything. Gave us Coppola, Lucas, Scorsese, and Spielberg. And everything from Annie Hall and Badlands in Chinatown and Dog Day Afternoon and The Exorcist to do some bad ones. But then Hollywood began to figure out what consistently brought the most money. 3X structures, action movies, rom-coms, animations, superhero sequels, and the age of heavily funded experimentation of studio avant-garde of pushing the envelope of what's possible rather than relying on what's tried and tested and known to be lucrative came to an end. And this is where I think it gets really interesting. So Joe suggested that there are three things that golden ages require. One, an ecosystem big enough to include both a handful of superstars and a horde of talented craftspeople.
Silicon Valley.
Two,
boom.
A culture of mixed sharing and competition, of mutual iteration, of openly seeking out and absorbing and building on one another's work. These are things
Instagram, Snap.
Yeah.
Got it.
These are things that the Valley has in spades and which... things which are very hard to reproduce by fiat elsewhere, which is why the next Silicon Valley attempts almost always fail, and why non-compete clauses are an immediate fatal death blow to such aspirations. The third necessary ingredient, though, is the most interesting. She holds that golden ages only happen when they include people outside of the mainstream, people with new ideas and different backgrounds, people who wouldn't ordinarily get funding. These are the people who do new things, who make qualitative rather than quantitative leaps. And basically what the conclusion is what kills all of these golden ages is the idea of the outsiders going away because the thing that is being disruptive, the thing that is burbling and constantly investing in new ideas and trying new things, decides they figured out how to. They sorted it out. They figured out what the equation is, and then they became institutionalized, and they only rely on people that they know, known quantities. Michael Bay keeps making the same Transformer movie over and over.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, sitcoms, you can see it. They get their formula, and then they keep going. Then you get maybe a couple years in, and you go, okay, I've seen this. It's no longer interesting. And
yeah, so put it simply, as the Valley becomes the establishment, and it also becomes more more reluctant to experiment, more reluctant to try weird new things and take risks, and more prone to giving more money to the same kind of people to do the same kind of things. That isn't what happens in golden ages. That's at best consolidation and at worst stagnation. Yeah, so it's really fascinating because that's something that, it is when you're in the middle of a golden age, it's hard to see it ever ending. And I think that there are people in the tech industry that kind of feel it a little bit. They feel the impending doom, especially with the slowing down / ending of Moore's Law. The idea that we're getting to that for the last couple of decades, huge progress has been made on the back of just ever increasing horsepower.
Well, that was interesting. Yeah, I'm going to cut you off there because that was kind of what Mossberg was writing about in his article. It's like it feels like it's slowing down. Now, he took the optimistic path of saying we're just revving up for a new wave. But this guy's saying, maybe not.
Yeah. I think what's important is that it's like,
not to say it disappears. Movies still clearly come out.
Oh yeah, and
art still happens. Disney's, it just may not be a golden age.
Disney is still one of your biggest companies out there. There's still these gigantic things. It's not Renaissance. You know, Renaissance was a special thing in that it changed.
Okay, fair enough.
It created a cultural meme that changed how people understood.
Is that bad?
What? That it ended or that it started?
I'm questioning the fact that we're exiting a Renaissance is bad.
No. Well, especially because I think the...
Or a golden age, whatever.
I think the important part about the Renaissance is that it was... No, I would agree that it's not bad because the important part about the Renaissance and what it brought about was this sort of like, okay, we're gonna redefine what is culturally acceptable and how we think through ideas, what is culturally important. And it has had an enormous, long-lasting effect on Western culture and arguably world culture because the West is really, you know, pushed out into the rest of the world. And it was huge for changing how we thought. And I think that it is not going to be unfair to talk about the tech industry as similar to the Renaissance as opposed to the Industrial Revolution, because I think that by the definition of what the tech industry is it's a new way of thinking. How do we think through problems? How do we offload our thinking onto other things? And so it will continue to have this profound effect, and it will give birth to other golden ages and other types of Renaissance in the same way that the Renaissance laid the groundwork for industrialization. But it's really exciting when you're in the middle of a Renaissance. It's like fun. Lots of people get really rich and famous. And if you want to be one of those people that kind of goes down in the history books as Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo, you're running out of time is what we're getting at. This is a period of time that will be studied in history books. And if you don't get your name in that history book in the next couple of years, it might be over. I think we probably are going to see the whole thing start to slow in the next decade. And there's just too many pieces of the puzzle that are moving into place to slow it down. You know, if net neutrality, if the internet can be censored by a lot of companies, it can be slowed down, which will really take a big hit on what kind of growth can occur. The more that these big companies consolidate and take over and sort of become the tried and true, same thing.
I was just thinking there could be natural things like to make a good app.
Yeah.
It's harder and harder to just sit down and do it.
Right.
You know, the expectations for design and functionality and, well, not app size yet. But that's be huge, apparently. You know, that just makes it difficult, more and more difficult for, you know, let's say I've got a brilliant idea. For me to do it and have it take off, it has to be done with a level of excellence that I cannot provide.
Right.
Which I think is part of what it's exciting about this AR kit, because you're like, oh, this brings it back down to level zero or level two.
Right, exactly.
Know? Like, I feel like I look at some of the stuff they're doing, I'm like, I don't know. I don't think it's so new. It doesn't have to be polished.
Right.
I think is what I'm trying to say. And so it feels more like this wild west, golden age-ish type of thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, if you were to do an email app,
oh my gosh, right? Yeah, the minimal viable product on an email app is incredibly complex. The minimal viable product on an AR app is incredibly simple. And you know, I think what gets me is that it's like, you know,
so I think there are regulatory barriers, but I think there's just also, as development happens, it gets to a point where it's like, no, dude, you got to make this thing look good. You can't just code up a homepage anymore. You actually have to have it designed.
And yeah, exactly. And not to mention the fact that it's like...
I mean, you can, but it's just not going anywhere.
If you're a boat trying to navigate deep into a countryside and you're going through all sorts of rivers and tributaries, it can be very difficult. And that's what development is like sometimes, trying to find a port deep into the mainland. And Moore's Law hasn't been like the tides. Moore's Law has been like a tidal wave, just covering the entire plain with water. So there's suddenly ports everywhere. You can get anywhere you want to. Just take your boat there. And the tidal wave is running out of energy. And that is going to have huge and hard to define consequences, because what it does is that it means that every new step, the MVP becomes more difficult to build, because
which is not the end of the world.
It's not. It's in it at all. You're still going to see development. You're just not going to see. It's going to change. And I think where you're really going to, and like I think,
yeah, it's going to change.
As we talked last year, I came up with my idea of like that, mountain climbing.
I thought too.
Mountain climbing. And one of the ideas that we talked about was how a lot of the technology in the tech industry is built around improving the technology in the tech industry. They're climbing their own mountains. And what we're finding, I think, and what the end of the golden age is going to be, is going to be getting to that peak and saying, okay, we've gotten about as high as we can get at a rate, at a accelerated pace. Now we're going to go and try to find the peak of other industries. And you'll see these really high-powered tech people go to other industries and see, if I take this technology and I implement it, where can I make money? For the last couple of decades, computer scientists who cared about artificial intelligence and machine learning spent all of their time working in schools and labs. And now all of a sudden, you can't hire enough of them on Wall Street. They're disrupting other... And you'll see that more and more, where computer scientists will just become these really esoteric ideas, sort of like physicists today, where they're diving into the deepest minutiae, and it doesn't necessarily feel like it has any application. I think that's the end of that golden... That's how we'll define the end of the golden age, is it'll just kind of spread to other stuff, and it'll be like...
Well, see, I think that's the other thing that we're doing, is we're redefining what is Silicon Valley and what are they working on.
Right.
They just define it as a place.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, because in terms of industry, it's like, whatever, you know, we don't care. Is it related to software? Is software involved? You're part of Silicon Valley, man. Yeah. You know, like that's how they broadened the definition. Because in some regards, you're like, from a computer standpoint, that golden age has been over for a while.
Well, yeah, especially because the Silicon Valley doesn't make silicon anymore. They do a little bit of silicon.
Which again, it's just a name.
Well, but yeah, it's a place, and it's a... You know, but it goes into what you're saying, which is the idea that, you know, in order to compare Alphabet to Fairchild of yesteryear, like the guys who invented the transistor, to compare them to Google is kind of disingenuous, other than it's the same area, you know?
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to think too, like, if you think about it in terms of location...
Yeah.
Like, there used to be, I'm trying to think, where's Ford, Detroit area, right?
Yeah.
Detroit, GM, like, they're on the Detroit.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Michigan?
Yes.
Okay.
Detroit, Michigan.
All right, good.
The big
That used to be a golden age. Everything was awesome. Amazing place to be in the world. And it's like, not so much anymore. Heck, if you have $1,000 cash, you can buy a house in Detroit. I would not recommend living there, but you can do it.
Yeah.
And so, it no longer has a golden age. Will you see that same thing happen in the Bay Area? There's a part of me that's like, the weather's nice enough. I doubt it.
Right.
That in of itself is enough of a draw. Will you maybe see where it stabilizes in terms of population growth? Yeah, okay, I could see that. I mean, there has to come a point in time. I don't know. Look at places like China. You can pack a lot of people in a pretty small amount of space.
Yeah.
So what are you willing to live in? what are they willing to allow you to live in?
Yeah,
that's the restriction. And so, as clearly people in China have shown, like, they will live in a 200 square foot home. Like, that's cool. And so, which that sounds really small, but doable. And if you eat out all the time, I could see that.
Yeah.
If you have shared laundry, you could make it happen. Anyways, sorry, I'm just trying to figure out, like, my wife and I are talking about maybe building, well, officially be an ADU, but a tiny home in our backyard. And there's questions about, like, how small do you think we can get away with this? Because we don't want something huge. And I want, like, a 10 by 10. That sounds super small to me, though. I'm like, oh, that's 100 square feet. Boom. 200, that's luxury. Which, bathroom, bedroom, kitchen. Like, that's it. That's all it is.
Yeah.
Anyways, where was I going with this? Do I see that coming to an end? Yeah, eventually. I think you just have to.
Yeah.
Because you run out of space and people start to sprawl and go somewhere else. But you'll notice they kind of, like, San Francisco is now part of that.
Yeah, exactly.
It used to not be. And who knows, someday I think, like, right now they kind of give Santa Cruz a pass, but maybe not forever. Like, maybe that someday becomes part of it. Or you go up north. I don't know. I think that's what will happen. But I think it's from just a software standpoint, I don't think we're going to, or the internet maybe. I think we got a ways to go for that to end, to be honest.
Yeah.
Just because there are still, as you said, other mountains to climb. And there's some real obvious ones that just haven't really been tackled yet. And there's a bunch that are under attack. But yeah.
Yeah, no, I completely agree.
Interesting.
Yeah, good. I liked it. I thought it was a pretty good definition of...
So it's three things. It's... okay, I got to remember what they were now. I already forgot.
It's an ecosystem where you have superstars and a couple of superstars and a giant industry of craftspeople. So you have
I'm thinking, like, YouTube is an example. You got some superstars, and then you got us. And other normal people.
I think the craftspeople are the important part. It's basically
craftspeople.
What it's saying is, like, this there's an interesting idea in, like, how you build a movie. Where why do movie studios green light movies that they know aren't going to be blockbusters? And for the longest time, the reason why they did that is because they knew that only a small number were going to be blockbusters, but they require a huge crew of skilled craftspeople who have to be employed all the time. And so you would make movies at a loss just to keep those people employed throughout the year so that when the giant blockbuster came around, you'd have these highly skilled craftspeople ready to go.
Construction owners who do that.
And yeah, you know, that's, yes.
I'm not saying our dad, I'm just saying in general. Yeah, I didn't make any money, but I paid my guys, kept them from going somewhere else.
Yeah, that's, you know, and that's a normal business practice, and that's important to keep it going, is you need this.
I was just thinking in terms of, like, just straight up companies, which is why I went down the YouTube route of, like, you got some big ones, obviously, Apple, Google, those guys. But then you have a bunch of successful in their own right, but smaller players. I like the craftsman idea. And same with YouTube. I read this YouTube article. I have YouTube envy right now. So
I can tell. Because I'm like, that, I'm not sure that necessarily correlates. But
well, just that idea of you got some superstars on YouTube. People with millions of page views and hundreds and thousands of subscribers. And then you have others who they make good videos that maybe very niche or something like that. But it adds this idea of a thriving ecosystem.
Yes, you're right. So the number
continue.
Yeah, the number two one was a culture of mixed sharing and competition.
Mixed sharing and competition. Dude, YouTube totally fits.
I don't know. Mutual iteration, openly speaking out and absorbing and building on one another's work. So basically saying,
okay.
So this isn't necessarily. I mean, obviously, Facebook ripping off Snapchat is an example of that. But I think more importantly, it's things like Python and the Node Package Manager, anywhere where you have these giant GitHub databases of open and free collaboration where people are building the tools that other people can use at zero cost. Those, I think that's where really where it's talking about.
That makes sense.
People are iterating with each other, are working together competitively and cooperatively to build the next great thing. And that's where you get the clash of the craftspeople with the superstars working together primes you for something, and then it's the outsiders that really set the whole thing.
And that's how you feel right now. That's how we feel, or why we get excited about what happened with Apple and their AR kit, where you feel like you had a superstar company who just collaborated with the craftspeople,
right?
And all the craftspeople get to build off of what the superstar did.
Yeah,
and you go, whoa, cool.
And what we're talking about, the thing that we're bringing up when we talk about that this is the first iteration, what we're saying is that there is an outsider. There is somebody who sees the world differently, is going to look at these tools and go, how can everybody miss what is so obviously the next big thing?
It was like the moon landing, yeah, right? Exactly. I was like, I never even thought of that. What? And that's a thing.
And there is going to be a technology. There is going to be somebody who is going to become a superstar who will build an entire company around something that Apple just gave them the option for. And
because that's the third thing, right?
Right.
The outsider.
The outsider. It's not the entrenched. It's not the craftspeople. It's not the entrenched. It's not the entrenched people that are going to bring you some new innovation. It's the outsider who thinks different. And
okay, like what's that idea?
Yeah, okay. So the whole point here, James, is it's really hard to come up with. And what's that idea?
I mean, I feel like there's some we've seen the obvious ones, like even though the measuring tape blew my mind, but you're like, okay, you can measure things, you can play games, and or the types of games is you're inserting objects in the world that you can interact with.
I am telling you.
Here's the type of object.
I personally think, and maybe this is just because of where I come from and what I do for a living, but I think that we are, that a lot of the entrenched engineering platforms, the non like high-tech stuff, but the civil engineering, mechanical engineering, bioengineering, I think a lot of those guys have only just seen the iceberg on the horizon of what this is going to give them. There is I actually think that this is one of those weird ones where the engineers haven't started using it yet. And they're the ones that are going to be like, actually, super high precision, like, there's real money here. There's industry here. There is something here that wasn't here before. I know exactly. And and I think that's going to be huge when it really starts to take off. This idea of I can design a high precision model in 3D on my computer, and then my boss can just look at it on the shop floor on his phone, which is not something you can do yet. And it's just, oh my gosh, it's just missing it. And you can see them scratching at the surface of that. But like a full featured actually works is very like, it is really useful in an engineering setting, doesn't exist. And
well, fine. Here, I'll take it from my perspective as a landlord. I want to be able to hold my phone up and see behind the walls.
Yeah.
When you build a house or you do a repair, take an AR video of it, and then when I stand there, I want to see where the pipe is.
That's actually-
I want to know, if I go in a cut here, what am I going to hit? It's my stud finder.
That would be, that's an interesting one. See, that's a pretty good idea. It's a stud finder. How do you couple information we have about drawings of the house with the ability to use Wi-Fi to penetrate walls with AR, combine all that information together and say, you can just hold up the phone and see where the studs are. And like, that would be pretty neat.
But it's going to take something like that where they just go, oh, why not? Or wouldn't this be nice if...
Well, and it's the outsider perspective is important because it's stuff that the AR guys wouldn't think about. Right now, AR is built on two different technologies. It's built on the Unity graphics engines, Unity, Unreal, like your graphics guys, your high-powered video stuff, because it needs to be rendered very quickly on lightweight systems. So those guys focus them on it. And the artificial intelligence machine vision guys, they've come together to build this light platform. And they've now built they've built scaffolding that other people can build on top of. And they're not thinking about it in terms of mechanical engineers. They're not thinking of it in terms of landlords. They're not thinking of it in terms of, you know, I'm trying to think of something that they're not thinking it in terms of. But this is why it's hard, and yet why it's valuable. Because it's the things that the guys on, it's, yeah, everybody thinks of, oh, it'd be cool to visualize a carbon atom in space in front of me for school kids. Like, everybody thinks of that. That one's not going to be revolutionary. So give me something that is revolutionary. Combined two or three different technologies together that nobody had ever thought of combining. And give me something different. Teach me how to see sound.
Audiobooks and...
I don't know.
Actually, that's what I tell people. Interesting. When someone's looking for a job and they're like, I want to do, project management. I was like, great. Combine that with something and then you'll be interesting.
Yep.
And... and you're saying essentially the same thing. It's, okay, AR plus two other things, essentially.
Yeah.
And
interesting. Yeah, give me something that AR is hard to understand, but it just got easy. Now give me something else that's still hard to understand and combine that you're good at that nobody else has thought about. Put AR on it, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that
maybe Amazon can use that with their new clothing box thing.
Pretty exciting. I don't know. I like it, man. There's some good stuff here. I'm excited. I got an idea for a HomeKit thing. Now that you can actually build. Sure? Yeah, no, it's really simple. What I really want, I want an audio switcher where you can plug in multiple sources and you can output multiple outputs, and you can control the volume of each of the outputs independently. And I want it to act like a HomeKit thing where I can just control the little knobs on it super easily. And I want that. That would be really useful for me right now.
Should make it after you finish my project.
I know. Don't worry, James. I'm thinking about it. But yeah, so that's pretty cool. Hey, cool. So speaking of, so as we dive into the golden age, you know what the best part about golden ages are, James? Sometimes the craziest things happen. Like a camera app becomes a map app all of a sudden, inexplicably.
Weird.
So Snap, the camera company, bought a social mapping app for around $300 million. They actually did this a little while back, but they finally confirmed it, and the price got the price range got leaked out. And the reason why that became a big deal is because you can now open up the mapping feature in Snapchat. You cannot, but
I deleted it.
I know. I remember. If you open up Snapchat after you download it, you just pinch to close with a, or it's like, you gotta do like multi, I can't do it consistently. It's like a multi, oh, there you go. Do like four finger pinch on the main screen, and it brings up,
I have to clip my nails.
And it brings up a map, and on.
Hey, you have a perfect week standing, congrats.
Thank you. And on this map, you can then click on it, and you can see
tap on
different like there's a map with all these little like hot spots where people are, and and you can like click on videos and see what videos are being made. It's kind of neat. It's kind of dumb. I I'm not sure I exactly get it. why this is such a good thing. There's a bit of a concern about security and privacy, because it is not entirely clear when your snaps get posted to this map, and so people can find you on the map and know your location.
Whatever.
I know. But there are people who...
don't use it.
Well, yeah. Okay, fair enough. But, yeah, so...
I guess teenagers are dumb. Teenagers are dumb. Maybe you should have some sort of... I don't know. Make it obvious.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the thing that gets me is, man, this company, they've just got, what are they doing with their life? I sit here and I'm like, seriously, what is this? It's you're trying to make the argument that you're a camera company, right? That you don't build, you're not a social media company, and you build this map into it that, it's, I don't know.
Well, it's almost like, so Instagram kind of has that.
Yeah.
Where you can tag a location, and in theory, you could use some sort of third-party app to see where the pictures were taken.
Right, well, and it's a feature that Snapchat, or that the Instagram had, and got, they, like, you could look at maps, and they got rid of that feature, because they're like, nobody uses this. This is dumb.
Yeah, it just turned into a tag.
Yeah, and, like, you can do it with your own pictures. I don't know, man. I don't know. What are they doing with themselves? Yeah. It's funny, I was having a conversation last night, and I just kind of threw out there, like, we were talking about different stuff, and then I was bringing up Snapchat, and I was like, yeah, the dying company, Snapchat. And so they're like, Snapchat's dying? I was like, yeah, it's over for them, man. It's like, it's really harsh. And they were like, really, like, wow, I had no idea.
You're gonna do it. You're gonna kill their own golden age. You personally.
Yeah, there might be some opinion baked into this factual report, if I'm honest, which I don't want to be. But
yeah, I guess that could be cool if you're bored and looking around. It just gives you a.
It lets you know where the cool places are. Which, let's be honest, yeah, I get it. LA's popular. Great. San Francisco's big. Cool. Like, I don't. What do you want from me? Maybe I'm just wrong age. Maybe I'm so uncool. I don't understand why it's cool.
Maybe you zoom in. You can see where your friends are in the school or in town.
And yeah, like. I don't troll their discovery and their and the stories anyways. I don't really use the app, so maybe I'm completely the wrong person. Maybe this is a great innovation on an already cool product. It feels incredibly iterative and doesn't really bring anything to the table. That's new and super exciting.
I could see where, you know, if they're trying to get you to use it more. I mean, they're definitely doing this. See what hits and sticks, and so they have their, well, you've got your friends list, and you see whatever they've posted, and then eventually those dry up, and then they've got their stories of special events and other stuff, and eventually you hit all those, and those dry up, and I got their news articles, but let's be honest, you're in high school, you don't care, and so...
Yeah, I mean, I guess, and then, I could see, maybe conceivably, if it's a Saturday night, and you go to a downtown, and it's dead, and you're like, where is everybody? I thought this was going to be a big night, and then
I think it's just a different explorer. I don't actually see it as that, necessarily. I don't see it as a plan out your evening type of thing. Yeah, should we go downtown or should we go uptown? Like, I don't see it necessarily as that. I think it's like,
it's such a dumb company.
Okay, I'm just gonna say this. I see it as like, you're going to the bathroom trying to kill time. Yeah, let's see where people are at and what they're up to. You know, like, that's whatever. I mean, that's how I see it.
The golden age of the internet.
That's my, like, you're just, it's a different way of the Discovery tab. That's all.
Yeah, I would agree. What a dumb company. Let's move on.
Okay. Oh, it's me.
Yes.
What are we doing? Oh, yeah. Okay, so I thought this was interesting. Just kind of a... I don't know what our theme is anymore. These thought pieces. And we like... Okay, so insider tip, if you've made it this far, we'll let you in on one of the things that we're thinking about is kind of doing more like thought piece type of like maybe answer a question or dive into a topic because we like that. Maybe like asking the question of how does X impact the future of whatever just happened with X? These kind of like these deeper thoughts things, try not to just repeat news, but try to like think on top of it. Anyways, we're thinking about that. If you love that idea, let us know. this was a cool thing on Medium by Brad Ellis. I have no idea who he is. He's an interaction designer, apparently. And that's my dog. And I love this. He's like, we should kill the nav bar. We should get rid of it. It's stupid. And instead, we should call something called reach navigation. I loved it. Where he was like, he actually has this heat map type of thing.
Okay.
Said, look, when phones were small, back in the 4S and prior days, we'll just use iPhone as an example. He was like, you could reach the whole screen with your thumb, no big deal. Maybe the one that was difficult, okay, if you imagine you're holding it with your right hand, okay? And so like, make the motion while I speak. There's some natural zones, lower left, pretty easy, and then it kind of swipes up to the middle of the screen. It's like, in the older phones, you could stretch and you could hit the top, but like getting lower right where your thumb is, he's like, that could hurt a little bit.
Right.
It's like, and then we went from the 5 to 5S. Remember, they added an inch or half an inch to the top of the phone. It's probably only half inch, huh?
Yeah.
Anyways, he was like, you suddenly like, that you had getting upper left hand corner was a little bit of a trick.
Right.
And now he's like, and now we talk about the iPhone 6 and then the 6 Plus, right? I remember when we talked about this, like the first time I got the 6 Plus, I was like, this thing is like, I have to use it two handed.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how to use it one handed. I have since mastered the art of the one hand mostly,
yeah.
So it can be done. But essentially, he's like, there's a natural zone, a stretch zone, and then an owl. Ow. Ow.
Yeah.
My daughter would say, ouchie. Which, by the way, I've got all these cuts and bruises from the tough mutter we did.
Yeah.
And my daughter loves to go up to me and just put her hand on my knees, just go, ouchie. Ouchie. Just, wow. It's very empathetic of you. Appreciate that. I go, yeah, ouchie. She only picked at one of them once.
Oh, yeah.
Did not like my reaction and isn't doing that anymore. I was like, what are you doing? That hurts. Anyways, super sweet. Just ouchie. So there's the zone and it's primarily the entire, upper quarter of your phone screen. If you're trying to do it one-handed, I know for me, like the normal idea would be you rest your phone on your pinky. It's kind of the idea. Then you have your three fingers on the back of the phone and you're doing your thing with you're using it, touching the screen with your thumb. When I want to go to the top of the screen, I actually have this, I take the risk. I slide my pinky to the back of the phone, slide the phone up. And so I have all four fingers on the back of my phone kind of resting on it. And then I can reach wherever. It's a little risky, especially running the case naked, knocking on wood right now. But that's how I do it. And so he's just like, that's dumb. So I love this. He has a little pun in there. He says, so the nav bar, he goes, it's out of touch.
Ah.
With how we use it, I'm like, oh, yes, you've already won me over. And so he goes, the navigation bar, honestly, he's like, it's a throwback from the days of the desktop. right? Where we, I guess not on Windows, maybe for Apple.
Yeah.
He's like essentially saying, go to Windows. I guess that's his takeaway, is put the nav bars at the bottom. Don't be dumb. Or do it's more like more of the slider type of thing that you've got the navigation that's just always on the left or something, and you always know if I just swipe over, that's where I'll see it, instead of it being at the top. Or, again, just put it at the bottom. So, like, because a good example of that might be on Apple Music, where it's got the buttons along the bottom.
Yeah.
Just make that officially the nav bar, not just some buttons. So, like, yeah. This is, it's like, we could do this, guys. We could change the world.
Well, I think you're gonna be in a lot of luck because the next generation of the iPhone is going to look like the Essential phone, which it's looking more and more clear where it's gonna be a bezel-less phone, but that means that the speaker and the cameras that are up at the top are the screen is gonna like lip up on either side of it. And I have a feeling that they're going to try to get people to move away from that. I guess I'm bringing this up mostly to say, I said it was ugly when the Essential phone did it and a bad idea. And I still kind of think that. So,
well, he has a couple of renditions like where he took Safari and he was like, what if you put the address bar down at the bottom?
Yeah, that honestly,
crazy idea. And then he's like, and then, you know, normally like when you start typing on it, it'll give you suggestions. He's like, it's there, you type on it, and then maybe a card pops up from the bottom with more information and content that you can choose from. And he's like, so it's in the middle of the phone now, not just from the top. He's like, because it covers up the content anyway, so what's the difference? But it's like, but you're no longer having to reach to go up and tap on something. He shows a couple other examples of like that, yeah, moving it down to the bottom and having this idea of cards that flip up. It's like brilliant. If I ever do an app, which I might someday,
yeah,
that we're doing that. I like that idea.
I like it too. I'm in. You've sold me.
Make it easy on my thumbs,
yeah.
So I can get a bigger phone. So then I can move up to what is it? Your iPad mini,
yeah.
And then just not have a phone altogether.
There we go. Yeah, let's do it. Man, I went to the Apple store this week or yesterday. That new iPad Pro looks pretty good, but
the 10.5.
Yeah, this is ridiculous. I mean, maybe this is just me, and I would yell at people who say this sort of thing, but there's just more truth to it than there should be. I picked up the iPad Pro, I picked up the pencil, I flipped over to the note-taking app, and I started drawing immediately to test the pen. And then, to be fair, so I could get excited about Microsoft's offerings, I went across the hall to where the Microsoft store is. I walked in, I did the exact same thing. I grabbed one of their Surface tablets, I folded the keyboard back, and I went to look for an app where I could draw and take notes. And I was flagged with the notification of, do you want this to be in tablet mode or not? And I tried to hit it with the pencil and nothing happened. It took me like seriously 5 minutes just to get it to be in the right mode that I wanted it to be before I could start looking for it. And I just gave up. I didn't even try it. I was like, you know what? I hate that I'm such an Apple fanboy, but come on, Microsoft, get it together. You know who I'm not a fanboy of, though? Travis Kalanick.
Kalanick!
I feel like I finally took the time to learn how to pronounce his name consistently.
Well, that was just in time. Which room is he in?
Exactly. Oh, just enough time. Well, he's
the rejection room.
The rejection room. For me, it's what scene is he in. And it's the end of the episode.
So don't pay attention to what I said last week, because apparently I was wrong.
Yeah, last week we talked about how he was temporarily stepping down from the company, from the position of CEO, He was taking a leave of absence. I thought it was a PR move. And then this week, he completely stepped down. He is quitting as CEO.
Which in some ways I was right, because I said he was one of three major shareholders. And I said, as long as he's got the backing, and they said he did, of those two other people, he was good to go. Well, he lost the backing of one of them.
Yeah.
That did not help.
Exactly. Well, and and it's just crazy right now. There's an article that I was reading that I thought was, it talks about how Uber's VCs have some culpability in all of this, says industry watchers. Because right now they've got like multiple executive level positions, CEO, CFO, COO, general counsel, among other executive openings. This is not uncommon for leaders to suddenly depart for whatever reason, that the company and its boards weren't developing any viable candidates in recent years, in case Kalanick was hit by a bus for a company with 14,000 employees and a $70 billion market cap. That's nuts. There is just this like weird thing going on with Snapchat right now, where they seem to be completely off the rails. And
you mean Uber?
Sorry, did I say Snapchat?
Which in some ways I was like, he could mean that.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's
no, I meant Uber. And it's like,
dude, they're tailspin free fall.
Oh, yeah.
Like I'm thinking like the scene in Top Gun where they get caught in the jet wash. And the plane, the engine stalled out, and then they're in a flat tailspin. And right now, Goose is going, mayday, mayday.
Yeah, it is.
You know, I can't reach the ejection handle. I can't reach the ejection handle. Like, that's what's happening right now. Yeah,
exactly. And it's like, and it's amazing because they've got this, it's a big thing.
I love that movie.
I know.
I want to go watch it again. I had that thought the other day. I was like, man, I want to go watch it.
Ryan, can I get you upset about something really quickly? Rotten Tomatoes. For some reason this came up. I was looking it up, and Top Gun, 1986, the year of my birth, got a 56% on Rotten Tomatoes. That just seems unfair.
I feel like it came out before Rotten Tomatoes, and it's just, I think for any, that's hard. It'd be interesting to see the reasons why.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. Part of me that's like, it's not a PG-13 movie for starters.
Yeah, well.
It's definitely a rated R movie to today's standards.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. I'm not totally surprised. I feel like it's either, actually, it'd be interesting to see the, they don't do histograms and stuff, I know, but it's like, I bet you there's people who like love it, and then people who are like, eh.
Yeah. You're either, this is the greatest movie ever, or kind of like, duh.
I regularly, there'll be people like, I love that movie. It is the best movie.
Oh,
ever.
Yeah.
But it's not everybody. It's not everybody. And it's like, and there's some people like, yeah, it's a movie, but like, that's one of them where I seriously like multiple people.
I agree.
But the people
who love it.
But it also, you have the other where like, do you know how inappropriate that movie is? Like, well, yeah.
Yeah, but still,
it's a great movie.
Exactly. Yeah. So how did I get here? I do not remember. Oh,
I don't know.
Atlantic.
We were talking about they're in a tailspin and going.
Yeah,
down.
Well, and it's just one of those things where this is a company that was, you know, it has a $70 billion market cap. They're worth so much, it's crazy. Eventually, they're going to IPO. It's going to be this giant payday, and nobody wanted to rock the boat. Travis was in charge, and as long as he and his two cohorts were on the same page, the last thing he wanted to do is not, you know, to rock the boat. You didn't want to be forced out for any reason. You didn't want people to buy your shares out. You want to make as much money off this thing as possible. You want that final payday. And the company was growing like crazy, and you knew that there were these systemic issues, but you just didn't...
Yeah, you also knew they were losing money. But yeah, systemic issues, yes.
And you just didn't... Nobody wanted to challenge Travis Kalanick. I'm going to say this as many times as I can. Take advantage of it. It's just pretty freaking amazing right now that this company is just Yeah, Tailspin's pretty good. I don't think it's going to end with Goose dying necessarily in this particular case, but they are stumbling hard. And, you know, the one thing that they've got going for them is that...
I don't know. I read an interesting article on Vox that was saying that it said Uber needs to stop trying to conquer the world, which I know you're not like the biggest fan of them, apparently. I just learned that. So, oh, well. one of their statements was Uber probably isn't worth $68 billion. I went, honestly. And they said there's going to come a reckoning with that.
Yes.
And he's like, and that's where things are going to get interesting. Because he says if you look at Lyft right now, they're valued at $7.5 billion.
Right.
That's it.
Which,
and it's like, and Uber's probably somewhere in the middle of the 68 and the 7.5.
It's probably closer to the 7.5 than the 68 by a pretty
far. Well, part of his thing is like their issue is they're losing money hand over fist. It's like because they're not charging enough, period. And they're spending a ton of money and time and effort on self-driving and even flying cars.
Yeah.
And so for him, he's like, this new CEO is going to come in. And he's like, he's going to do two things. He's going to simplify the R&D. And he's going to raise prices.
Yeah.
It's like, that's what's going to happen. And it's one of those where it's like, yeah, we got scale, but we make it up, you know, but what is it? We lose money on each unit, but we're making up in volume.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, no, you're not.
Yeah.
And a new guy's going to come in and say, we're not doing that anymore. We're getting rid of the flying cars. Yeah, we're going to focus on self-driving, assuming that
I'm going to say, well, what they'll probably end up doing is they'll probably go the same way that Lyft is going, which is they'll move the R&D onto somebody else. Somebody else who can afford it, who's already making big progress, and they'll just be the partner application for whoever comes out. They won't own the fleet. They won't own the technology. They weren't going to own the technology anyways because Waymo was going to sue the technology and take it back, but now they definitely won't. They won't be able to afford it, and they'll be like Lyft. They want Uber to be your first stop when you try to figure out who you're going to get your car from, self-driving or otherwise. And that's going to be their goal. And I totally believe they're going to chase what Lyft is doing. And, you know, if Lyft gets lucky, then they'll have these really cheap self-driving cars first. And people are going to be really sensitive to price. You're going to watch the price of Ubers go up dramatically. I agree. And people are going to use it less. And I don't know, whoever cracks self-driving car first, they're going to be the ones who gets a bunch of people moving towards them and away from the others, because they'll just be the cheapest. I think people are really sensitive to price in this one. People don't do a lot of comparison shopping. They don't open up Lyft. They don't open up Uber and see who's cheapest. They just get a sense of who's cheapest most consistently. And then once you sort of get stuck there, once you start relying on one, that's just your go-to every time. And yeah, I don't know. So if Snap or if Uber starts to prove to be more expensive, more consistently, that'll work out well for Lyft.
Yeah, or Lyft decides they actually want to start making some money and raise their prices with them. But I think they have a reason to go for the market share play.
Yeah.
At this point, I mean, they're both losing money, so I don't know if that matters, but I don't know. It was interesting. Now, not everyone's happy though, what I read, with him stepping out. So apparently over 1,000 Uber employees signed some document saying we'd like him to come back.
Yeah.
So talk about turmoil, right? It's not even this like, that's over with, let's all move on. It's like, no, it's not. You have 1,000, you know, which it's not.
Well, it's not a Travis number, Travis Kalanick is a bit of a, you know, he was an iconic what's it called? Not CEO, but you know, he was kind of, he'd become iconic. There were people that were going to go to Uber because not just because of what Uber was doing, but because of who was leading Uber, that it was their boss, and they want him because they think his vision is what was making Uber great. That's what they had bought into, was Travis Kalanick and his vision. And it would be, it would, yeah, there's a lot of people that work for Tesla and SpaceX that if Elon Musk left, they'd be like, okay, you know, I'm going to, this is my job. This is what I do. I still believe in the company and the culture. I'm going to stay with it. But there'd be a good number of people that would just be like, you know, without Musk, this is a sinking ship. Like, Musk is what makes this engine move. He's the nitrous in this thing. There were people that left Apple.
He's that guy who I was describing at the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
It's like it just draws you in and pushes you harder, yeah, than you think you
can. How many people left Apple at because Steve Jobs passed away and, yeah, Tim Cook took over? You know, there's a lot of people who stayed, who bought into, no, we'll keep with Tim Cook. But there were a lot of people who left, too, over time. So it's not shocking to me that, you know, it ends up being 7% of their company are there because of Travis Kalanick, and they're disappointed to see him go. And, you know, his vision is what they bought into, and now they have to find a new job. I think you're right. The company culture, the company is going to change, and the culture probably in a lot of ways is going to become better, but there are parts of the culture of how they do what they do, they're going to change, that people aren't going to be thrilled with. Like the idea of, you know, move fast, break things, you know, win at all costs. That's going to change. And there are engineers who aren't going to love that.
Yeah.
But. And there's probably a couple of, yeah, sexists in there too that have signed the petition just for kicks.
Yeah, that just, wow.
Yeah, exactly. Wow.
It'll be interesting to see where they are in a year. I don't, who would you have step in? That's a horrible job.
But, oh, yeah.
Because he's not gone. Oh, he's still going to be there in, yes, board meetings.
Yeah, he's still the largest shareholder, or the most votes. He's got the most votes out of anybody.
But still, that's like, you do it because you're getting paid.
He's
going to
be hanging around that company like a specter and just pestering everybody all the time. Yeah.
Well, from what I understand, even after he even said he was taking a leave of absence, he didn't.
Yeah.
They're like, he was the guy. He was instantly already talking to people, sending texts and other stuff. He just wasn't on the corporate network. They're like, come on, like that's.
He's, yeah, a.
I don't know who you would have come in who could rein him in, stand up to him, not get ticked after 9 months and get out.
I don't think you'll find anybody who can do that, James. Well, yeah, that's the problem, is he's going to want to approve whoever it is. And so you're going to have to get this, like, how do you get it? So how do you make it so that it's actually different? How do you convince, how do you change the company? How do you not just get somebody who's a mouthpiece for him? Well, that's what they're going to do. That's, I mean, like, I'm not exactly.
They'll find a Scully somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. It'll happen. Yeah. They'll find somebody that is handpicked and believes what Travis Kalanick believes in and is going to, you know. I don't know. It should be fun to watch. I'll bet there's a bunch of corporate culture. Hopefully, I didn't memorize how to say his name for no reason. I'll keep coming back. But now that's it. So the last story I want to talk about is this is just kind of interesting. Intel, a couple years ago, they started building boards that would be allow them to compete directly with things like the Arduino and the Raspberry Pi specifically. And they were really cool. And Yeah, and they're pretty like the Galileo and the Jewel, and they were just trying to get it in the Internet of Things, and this article was updated. That's why I paused there, because I was like, oh, did this article completely change? But yeah, they ended up killing a bunch of these product lines kind of unceremoniously. I guess they weren't taking off. It's hard for Intel, man. They have a hard time breaking into new markets for some reason.
Yeah, they got their thing that they do.
Yeah. Right? Eh, it'll be interesting watching this as time goes on. Time goes on.
Well, you know, they're willing to experiment and try stuff. Kill it when they have to. I can appreciate that.
Yeah, I agree.
You just wish they'd fire. I don't. Yeah, this is it's a strategy idea. It was in a book I read, Grip of Choice. This idea of like fire bullets and cannons, and it's like, yeah, fire some bullets, see what pierces, see what works, and then fire a cannon. And they're just still firing bullets. Yep. You know, I'm just saying, it's not hitting yet.
Yeah.
Eventually, you got to fire a cannon. But you know.
Yeah.
Whatever. They got time. They got time. Plenty of time.
Yeah. No worries. They're good.
Yeah. It's all good. Hey, they survived. They survived the smartphone miss. So.
Yeah, that's true.
They just can't miss the next one. But anyways, well, dude,
this is
300 episodes.
This is crazy.
Yeah, it is pretty crazy. Everybody, thank you for joining us, and thank you for listening to episode 300. We really do appreciate it. Don't forget, you can check out all the show notes and all the links for liberals.com. Episode, what is it? 300. That's right. If you'd like to get the show notes sent directly to you, you can also sign up on the page. You actually won't receive emails for a while after Monday, but you can still do it. And but we'll be back. Don't worry. And finally, this podcast is supported by listeners just like you. If you would also like to contribute, we've got four different levels. Maybe wait until you see our new format before deciding to do that. clearly, I'm reading a script. And so, so check that out for Liberos. See all the good articles. Really, check out the AR videos. They're super awesome. They're really cool. And so, on that note, I am James Furlow, my transforming brother over these last 300 episodes is Matthew Furlow, and so we will talk next time. Thank you.